as caffeine withdrawal and the associated headaches, fatigue, and nervous system dysregulation as a full-fledged medical disorder. Dehydration, which comes from the body trying to pass the caffeine quickly through the system, and sleep disturbances, which result from caffeine's 6-hour half-life, half of it is still in your system 6 hours past ingestion, certainly contribute to those symptoms and the overall disorder diagnosis. But the fundamental fact of the matter is that caffeine is a drug. It's one of the funnest, friendliest, most social drugs we know of, but it is still a drug that can do real damage. 4 cups of coffee or 400 milligrams of caffeine spread through the day is generally considered safe. But as little as 500 to 1,000 milligrams of caffeine at one time can be a fatal overdose, especially if you have a pre-existing condition that makes you more susceptible to caffeine's effects. As with any drug, the point is not to overdo it. Don't drink too much so you don't build up an unmanageable tolerance. Don't drink too much too often so you don't get addicted. If you want to reset your tolerance, research indicates that if you take a week off, you'll be back to normal. And don't drink too late so you don't hamper your ability to enter deeper sleep states. Avoid these pitfalls while adding good fats to your caffeine to flatten and extend its effects, and you are set up to enjoy one of our favorite pastimes and take advantage of all the mental and physical benefits it has to offer. Tobacco. If you're anything like my editors, you probably heard the word tobacco and figured this section would be one word long. Don't. How could it be when you consider that as of 2012, an estimated 1 billion people smoke tobacco, and countless others consume it in alternative ways, including traditional ceremonial use? We have to talk about it and get to the bottom of the mysteries of tobacco, because the problems we have with it as a society have little to do with the plant itself and more to do with how you get it inside you. All tobacco consumption carries the stigma of the misuse of cigarettes, aka death sticks, and the companies who manufacture and peddle them. It's understandable when you consider that cigarettes are the most ubiquitous tobacco product, and the evidence is pretty clear that smoking cigarettes is dumb if you like life. The tricky part for us, as we talk about owning the day and taking our work to the next level, is that nicotine, the active component of tobacco, while carrying its own risks, has a ton of performance benefits. For one, nicotine puts you in the fucking zone, also called flow. In mechanistic terms, nicotine fits into the same receptors in our brain as acetylcholine, the powerhouse neurotransmitter responsible for attention and memory, and is correlated with the alpha frequency brainwave state, similar to that produced by matcha tea, characterized by effortlessness, alertness, and creativity. An analysis of 41 studies on nicotine and cognitive performance concluded that nicotine safely improved fine motor skills, attention, accuracy, response time, short-term memory, and working memory. That's some Neo in the Matrix shit right there. It might also be why you see baseball players and elite military units lean on chewing tobacco as part of their routines. Hitting a 90-mile-per-hour fastball from 60 feet away, or pinging a moving target with 5.56mm ammo from 60 yards away, both take an incredible amount of focus, dexterity, accuracy, and muscle memory. So the game, then, with tobacco, isn't about determining whether or not it's useful, it's figuring out how to get the nicotine safely into your system while doing the least amount of damage. As Aldous Huxley famously said, you don't want to burn the house down to bake a loaf of bread. So before we burn the house down, or burn anything at all for that matter, let's take a look at the options for getting that delicious dope into your brain. Caveat: nicotine advisory. Let's get one thing clear. Nicotine isn't for everyone. It is definitely not good for developing brains, as some data suggests that anyone under 25 who uses nicotine may experience some cognitive impairment later in life. But even if you are over 25, you should proceed with caution. Even responsible nicotine use may cause seizures and involuntary muscle twitching, as well as abnormal heart rhythms, a slow heart rate, and fluctuating blood pressure. Vomiting is the most common symptom of nicotine poisoning, however, and it can begin as quickly as 15 minutes after ingestion. Beyond just poisoning, a full overdose of nicotine can be fatal. If you are going to dance with a plant as powerful as tobacco, it's good to have some respect and know the boundaries, yours and the plant's. Cigarettes, aka death sticks. The nicotine in cigarette smoke increases levels of three of the most pleasurable chemicals the brain can produce: dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin. These are chemicals the body is capable of releasing on its own, but since smoking a cigarette is such a novel activity, some researchers suggest that the act of smoking might itself trigger the release of these chemicals based on a conditioned response, much like Pavlov's dogs that drooled at the sound of a dinner bell even when food wasn't present. This is likely why alternative nicotine delivery systems have such a poor success rate. They just don't trigger the same response. And why you should please, for the love of shiny disco Jesus, stay the fuck away from cigarettes. You know the statistics already. You heard some of them earlier. Cigarettes kill. In large part because you aren't simply taking tobacco smoke into your lungs, you are bringing with it significant amounts of toxic, carcinogenic smoke as well, thanks to all that fun stuff the unscrupulous profit mongers at cigarette manufacturers have added to their product over the years to preserve the tobacco, accelerate the burning, and increase the addictiveness. There is the bleached white paper you are inhaling, for instance, and oh, just under 600 other chemical additives, 100 of which are psychoactive. I wonder, do you think any of those 100 are addictive? I'd ask the 35 million people who try to quit smoking every year and fail within a week, but they're all out taking a smoke break, again. Independent of the specific health risks, cigarette smokers are also less attractive to potential partners, have a tougher time finding a job, and even when they do, end up earning less money. I could go on, but I'm going to assume we trust each other at this point. I'm not going to give a lot of hard no's in this book, but this is one of them. Don't smoke cigarettes. There are better ways to get nicotine, and you're about to learn them. Smokeless. In a groundbreaking report, London's Royal College of Physicians determined that, as a way of using nicotine, the consumption of non-combustible, smokeless tobacco is on the order of 10 to 1,000 times less hazardous than smoking, depending on the product. They went on to suggest that smokeless tobacco manufacturers might market their products as a harm reduction option for nicotine users, and they may find support for that in the public health community. This evidence-based opinion has been highly contested here in the United States, primarily by Big Tobacco with their $117 billion in annual revenue to protect. So I'd go ahead and trust the good doctors across the pond on this one. Swedish snus, a moist tobacco powder you tuck under your upper lip, appears to be one of the healthiest forms of smokeless tobacco. One study showed little difference in overall health and life expectancy between smokers who quit entirely and smokers who switched to snus. With no sweeteners and fewer additives, if any, snus is a cleaner option than many of the American snuff or chew products. That said, the amount of nicotine you receive into your blood from smokeless tobacco can be equal to about 4 cigarettes. So for those of you thinking about making the switch, be mindful of the dose. For first-timers, this can really sneak up on you too. So tread lightly and make sure you have something to throw up into nearby if you aren't good at knowing your limits. We're not saying that smokeless tobacco, even snus, carries no risk at all. But there are elephantine advantages to choosing smokeless over cigarettes. Vaping. While some research on cells in a petri dish indicates that vapor may impair cellular function, particularly around wound healing, a lot more research needs to be done to determine the actual harm of inhaled vapor. For now, the best analysis comes from the same highly respected London Royal College of Physicians paper, which suggests that the hazard to health arising from long-term vapor inhalation from e-cigarettes available today is unlikely to exceed 5% of the harm from smoking tobacco. That is to say, it might be 20 times safer. And while they acknowledge there are no medical standards for the production of vapor, largely made of glycerin, though many have begun to move away from that, they strongly encourage all cigarette smokers to make the switch. Cigars and pipes. The big advantage of cigars and pipes is that you aren't meant to inhale the smoke into your lungs. To be sure, there is still some smoke being inhaled, and of course a lot of the same chemicals from the smoke still get into your blood through your gums. But the absence of significant smoke inhalation drops your risk for a lot of the cancers associated with cigarette smoking to virtually nil, especially in the case of cigars, if you are only smoking one or two per day. Pipe tobacco, in a ceremonial context, probably originated with our own Native American predecessors, who would smoke tobacco as a bonding ritual and to commemorate peace. In a Western context, we are most familiar with pipe tobacco in the mouths of ship captains, thank you, The Simpsons, European grandfathers, and old college professors. For pipes, tobacco is often steamed for hours to darken the color, then flavored and fortified with quite a few chemical additives that contribute to its mild, sweet smell and flavor. Pipe tobacco is smoked like a cigar, Bill Clinton style, don't inhale, so despite the additives, it's still a far better option for the positive mental performance attributes of nicotine than cigarettes. Nicotine gum or patch. This is the cleanest way to get nicotine into your system, period. With the clinical efficiency, however, the ritual and a lot of the fun is lost, which is why these alternatives don't work so well in helping people quit. But for the biohacker on a mission to optimize mental performance for short stretches, this is the cleanest way to do it. Final word. The bottom line is this. If you are smoking cigarettes, you need to switch to some other nicotine delivery method like vaping, cigar, or pipe smoking, gum, or the patch. And if you are interested in trying tobacco for the first time, it's extra important that you do it the right way. Even better, rotate the delivery so you are spreading potential stress to multiple different systems. Nicotine has tremendous advantages for mental sharpness and clarity when used appropriately. But when used sloppily and without clear intent, it is very easy to find yourself on a slippery slope to Addictionville. Plant nootropics and a peculiar little moss. Nootropic is a word that has some heat behind it right now. It's hard to pronounce and harder to define, but consensus is that a nootropic is any supplement, food, or drug that improves some aspect of mental performance. For me, the key definitional aspect of a nootropic is its intention to boost mental performance, as opposed to treating some mental disease state or deriving some ancillary benefit. Most don't consider caffeine and tobacco to be nootropics, for example. The studies show that they benefit cognitive performance, however, so if you are intending to use them for that function, they would fit squarely in the nootropic category. One of the most popular pharmaceuticals of our generation, Adderall, is prescribed to treat ADHD, but ends up getting crushed and snorted like a street drug to fight off fatigue and increase alertness. While that certainly can improve mental performance, the mechanism of action and intention of use is more as a stimulant, being only one single molecule away from the street drug methamphetamine. So is it a nootropic? If you're using it so you can drink more Fireball whiskey shots without falling down on your face, then no, it is a stimulant. If you're using it to compose a symphony, do people still do that? Then yes, it is. Huperzia serrata, acetylcholine, and other SAT words. The main plant nootropic we are going to focus on is something called Huperzia serrata, or club moss. H. serrata grows wild in Asia and has been likely used in local medicine for thousands of years. It has a very specific and well-defined mechanism of action, has an excellent safety profile, is not a classic stimulant, and targets one neurotransmitter in particular, acetylcholine. We have talked a bit about serotonin and dopamine, but we haven't talked much about acetylcholine. Acetylcholine helps neurons, brain cells, communicate better with each other. H. serrata contains a compound called huperzine A, which acts as a, drum roll for a big word please, acetylcholinesterase inhibitor. What that basically means is that it delays the breakdown of acetylcholine in the brain, providing a temporary surplus of the neurotransmitter and extending the duration of its action. A meta-analysis of the use of huperzine A for the treatment of Alzheimer's and related symptoms has shown marginal benefit. And as would make sense, studies done on this compound show benefits similar to what you would find for any natural or synthetic substance designed to increase available acetylcholine, namely memory and learning performance. I first learned about H. serrata after a visit to New York at the demand of my parents in my late 20s. They were worried that I was partying too hard and about to destroy my brain. One glance at my social media and I realized that argument was futile. They may have a point, so I agreed. What I didn't realize was that by agreeing, I was submitting myself to 4 days of testing, often hooked up to pointy hairnets with wires coming out. When all was said and done, the doctor told me that my mental hardware was okay, but the operating system was in serious need of support. He said the levels of all 4 of my major neurotransmitters were depressed, a sign of sleep deprivation, stress, and too much alcohol. Way too much. So he gave me a combination of some things to try. Some 5-HTP for serotonin, some mucuna pruriens for dopamine. Did I really need more dopamine? Some L-theanine for gamma-aminobutyric acid, GABA, modulation. And then this stuff that sounded like the name of an Argentinian soccer player called huperzine serrata, targeted towards acetylcholine. As much as I wanted to convince myself that my brain didn't need any help, the supplements worked. I was sharper, happier, and simultaneously more relaxed. But it was the huperzine serrata that really changed the game. The feeling was foreign at first, and then it was like the gears in my brain caught, and suddenly I was operating on a higher level than I usually did. I was hyper-focused and aware, but still calm. My heart wasn't racing, but I was awake, more awake than usual. I felt elevated in my thinking, able to form fluid, lyrical sentences whose internal logic held together no matter how far my thinking took me. I wasn't just able to articulate complicated ideas, I was able to focus on complicated tasks as well. Even my mind-body coordination seemed improved, as if I was reacting faster to external stimulus. It was this experience with the plant that eventually led me to place huperzine serrata at the heart of supplementing high brain function. This little power plant you've probably never heard of, when combined with the right nutrients, can help with word recall, solving complicated tasks, and even assist with the speed at which you register external stimulus, which is one of the reasons why it has become a staple performance enhancer for our athletes, from Super Bowl champions to Sunday tennis club soldiers. Final word. We live in a get-shit-done world, and our brain is our biggest ally. Supporting the brain with nutrients not only will help you perform better, but can keep your brain healthier over the long term. Huperzine serrata is a tool in your arsenal, a screwdriver in your set, and while you don't need to take it every day, on the days you need to be at your best, on days you want to own, you should have it available. Whether you wild harvest and brew them into a tea or buy them in bulk online, nootropics like this humble little fern-looking moss have contributed to a lot of beautiful things being made, not the least of which can be your perfect day. Now do it. It was Saturday, late morning. I had gotten some good sleep the night before. My wearable sleep tracker, the Oura Ring, showed an 84% sleep efficiency out of 100. I'll take that any day. I woke up and put in my human charger earbuds. I did 23 burpees, power shower. I had a great breakfast. I took my supplements. I sat here trying to write some of the pages of this book, and I couldn't get going. I had literally done everything to perfection, but I still needed help. I knew it was time for the caffeine. I decided on mixing up some coconut almond-flavored black tea with some heavy cacao-infused coconut cream. I brewed up the tea, put in a huge dollop of cream, steeped and stirred. As I started to sip, I noticed a familiar feeling in my bowels. It was a trained response, triggered as much from the taste as the effects. Yep, I needed to take a shit. If you're a caffeine person, you don't need me to link to a study here. The adrenaline triggers the desired bowel response, and the healthy fats ensure that everything is going to move along its merry way. And this is good because when you take a big bowel-emptying dump, you are literally a different person. The balance of cells, bacteria, and microorganisms that reside in your body shifts by billions. No wonder good authors like James Altucher recommend taking a dump if you are stuck with your writing. A lot of times it feels like writer's block is literally sitting in your large intestine. Remove that obstacle and the words start to flow. Everyone listening to this book is benefiting from my post-poop clarity, brought about by three plants, tea, cacao, and coconut. This is the power of plants in real time. The love affair between writers, caffeine, and nicotine is both universal and eternal. Why? Writing is a beast. It is the birth of pure ideas into the messy symbolism of words. Your creation may get rejected, debunked, ignored. So when confronted by a beast like the pearly white snarl of the empty page, you need to call on your allies. If I'm writing, working late, podcasting, or playing chess in the boardroom, it is caffeine, nicotine, and alpha brain that I bring to the front lines. But of course these plants aren't just for the hard tasks, they are also allies for the love of life. At sunset, I will smoke a good cigar and look out on the playground of my yard with the foxes, the rabbits, the lizards, the snakes, the falcons, and all the plants in my garden that feed and nourish me, sending out gratitude in the form of smoke rings for the gift of being alive. I'll have a cup of coffee Thanksgiving morning with my mother as she bastes the turkey, and we chat about her latest spiritual adventures. I'll take some alpha brain before a round of golf in a desperate attempt to shoot under 100, until I finally surrender with a laugh at my 107. It doesn't really matter what you use the plants for, as long as your relationship with them is healthy. Your goal is to be better, at your work, at your relationship, at being alive. It's the same with anything. These plants are miraculous, powerful allies that can help you achieve amazing shit, sometimes literally, but they can also have power over you if you allow them to. If they are controlling your life, consider the well-established practice of harm reduction, and find ways to transition to a less harmful method or frequency to limit your downside exposure. To check myself, I'll pause with them for a week or sometimes even a month, just to make sure I'm not convincing myself of anything that isn't true. Know the plants, know yourself, be honest, and decide the terms of your relationship with them. If it can be healthy, it will enhance more than just your performance, and you'll have an advantage in everything you do for as long as you live. Three pointers. Caffeine is ideal to alleviate sleepiness and improve your mood. To do it the right way, look for natural plant sources. Make sure you don't interrupt your sleep and blend with fats to help slow down the release into your body. Nicotine on its own can be beneficial to focus, attention, and the enjoyment of your day. The problems come with the delivery. Never inhale smoke. Instead, look for other means like vaping and absorption through the gums or the skin to get you in the zone. Nootropics have been proven to assist with memory and cognitive performance. Huperzia serrata is a great place to start and is a part of one of the most rigorously tested formulas on the market. If you don't know about nootropics, now is the time to find out. Chapter 7. Do and work. Whatever is worth doing at all is worth doing well. Philip Stanhope, 4th Earl of Chesterfield. We are built for work. It is never going to go away, nor would most of us ever want it to. It is part of the balance of life, and however you define it, you will always have work to do. To derive as much meaning, pleasure, and value out of this inescapable part of life as possible, you need to know your mission, whether it's related to the work itself or not. Then you need to own your workspace and work as effectively as possible. Because what makes work feel less like labor is when you know why you are doing it and how to do it well. Getting owned. I once had a boss who decided that his employees were cheating him on the amount of time they worked at the office. He complained about the few extra minutes at lunch, in the morning, grabbing coffee, going to the bathroom, because he was paying for that time. Any bit of it not used for work was therefore theft in his mind. Every day we were actively stealing from him. Trying to clamp down on wanton thievery, like a Chinese buffet clamping down on wanton thievery, our boss instituted a time measurement policy where all salaried workers, including executives like myself, had to fingerprint in and out of the office. The policy worked, kind of. Nobody took those extra minutes for themselves anymore, just like our boss wanted. Instead, we all stayed at our desks, just like he hoped, and fucked off 5 times as much on the internet. Whoops. When I walked around the office and looked at employee computer screens, I was more likely to see Facebook or YouTube open than Photoshop or an Excel sheet. This loss of productivity wasn't something unique to our unhappy workplace. Companies have lost billions in revenue and workers $3 trillion in labor thanks to hours lost to Facebook alone since the site crossed the 100 million user mark in 2008. But even that, I think, misses the point. Time is the wrong metric to use when we evaluate work. Because it's not just about how much time you work, it's about how effectively you use that time. Before the fingerprint scanners, we were pretty effective because we were reasonably content. What my boss didn't understand was that any productivity issues we had weren't time-related. They were process and passion-related. So when he made it about time, not only did it feel like a punishment, it made all of us miserable, which resulted in a massive decrease in effectiveness, much of it purely out of spite. That's the thing about work. It is simultaneously our greatest inner virtue and our biggest pain in the ass. When the balance gets upset, we get unhappy, and it tips us into a negative space. Workaholism on one end, Facebookaholism on the other. In my mind, neither of those things should happen, because work, by which I mean the act of completing tasks for some purpose other than pure pleasure, is not the be-all and end-all. Work is just what we do. We are cut out for it. Just look at the human body. The proportions of our upper and lower torso, the length of our arms, opposable thumbs, prehensile digits, the musculature in the abdomen and the lower back. Then look at our brains, solving puzzles for the future with the tenacity of a caffeinated child prodigy palming a stack of Rubik's Cubes. You know how I know that humans built the Great Wall of China? Because our bodies basically make us walking construction cranes, and our minds love nothing more than to play Legos with real life. Unfortunately, over the centuries, we've allowed our unique capacity for work to define us as living beings. And somewhere along the way, we got so far out of balance that now 80% of people are dissatisfied with their jobs. The average person works 90,000 hours in their lives. That's a long time to be miserable. Especially because if you hate your work, then you're going to spend even more hours being miserable just thinking about how much you hate it. For the 40% who say their job is very or extremely stressful, quickly those 90,000 lifetime hours of suck become 150,000. And before they know it, they are truly slaves to the hamster wheel of work. How did we get here? Is it because people have gotten lazier and more entitled? I don't think so. Is it because they are blowing their work-life balance? Probably in part. In the United States, workers take an average of 57% of their paid vacation days. That's crazy. You've got 90,000 hours to knock out. Take the chance to chill on the beach when someone gives it to you. Or just stay at home and tell everyone you were in Bali. You know how nice it is to be home with no obligations? It's like heaven. But at least it's better in the West than in Japan, where 10,000 workers per year drop dead at their desks as a result of 60 to 70 hour work weeks. The phenomenon is so prevalent that it even has a name, karoshi, proving once again that when it comes to forms of honorable suicide, no one fucks with the Japanese. I think the biggest problem with all the dissatisfaction is that in most cases people are bringing the wrong mentality and the wrong expectations into their workplace. They think if they work long enough and make enough money, eventually whatever happiness they are postponing will just sort of arrive. If that were true, then why do studies show that the peak income correlated to happiness is $83,000? Surely not enough money to solve what most of us would consider to be typical problems. It's because there is no amount of work you will do that will finally make the work go away, and definitely no amount of money you can make that will solve all your problems. And the sooner you realize that, the sooner you can look for happiness in places where it might actually be found. Many of you have already far surpassed that magic salary number. For you, it may not be mo money, mo problems, like Diddy said. It's still Diddy, right? But it's definitely mo money, different problems. Those of you who are still working your way up to $83,000 are probably saying, "Give me those rich person problems any day, homie." And I hear ya. That's why I had no intention of stopping at $83,000 a year either, and why guys like Gary Vaynerchuk admit they were willing to eat shit for 20 years to be where they are today. What sets guys like Gary V apart from the rest of us, though, is that he enjoys his work. He doesn't just embrace the grind, he relishes it. He's working towards something, and that something matters to him. That is why he is such a colossal force. That's also how I've been able to grow on it at an average of 40% a year since 2012. When people come visit the office, you know what they say? It's not, "Man, Aubrey, your employees are working so hard." It's, "Man, your employees are so happy." And happiness is a magnet for success. Happy people do better work and draw other happy people to them. I never have to beg people to stay late to finish a project or volunteer to work a trade show because I am constantly supporting their personal journeys of self-optimization, financially, physically, and emotionally. And it's not just my company. These principles are being adopted by many of the best and biggest companies in every industry. The worst thing in the world is to feel like you are getting owned by your job or your employer. So what is the formula for owning your profession and being happy at work? Sure, working at a company you love helps, but it isn't essential because you are the master of your internal environment. The formula has three parts. You need a mission you believe in, you have to own your own space, and you have to work effectively. Owning it. The unhappiest time of my life was right after college. I started a marketing company, and my only client at the time requested that I work full-time in-house. Desperate to prove something, not just to him, but to myself, I poured my heart and soul into my client's company. And even though I wasn't very good at marketing yet, we started to see some serious progress. Through a few good ideas and relentless effort, online revenue went up 800% over the course of 3 years. What was my reward? A demotion. For reasons completely unrelated to me or my performance, I was being punished for my success. Despondent and demoralized, I quit. For the next year or so, I cobbled together enough work with other clients to work my way out of the darkness. That was the nature of the marketing hustle. In a single day, you could go from comfortable to desperate. There were very few easy days. Eventually, comfort came calling again. My first client wanted me back and offered me a gigantic monthly paycheck to come back in-house. I weighed my options carefully. The last year I worked there had been the most emotionally challenging of my life. I knew that if I went back, the same thing would happen again, and any shot at being happy in my work would go down the drain. Mission implacable. I needed a strategy. I needed a mission. A very clear why that was just my own, that would function as a lodestar to help me chart a course through the treacherous, volatile waters of this particular workplace as I made my way toward the overarching objective of my life. Everyone needs a mission. Imagine the totality of your being, your work product, your energy, your will, expressed as a force. You could say that every force has a fundamental desire, which is to be applied to maximum effect. A bowling ball's desire is to knock down all the pins. The sun desires to burn bright and hot, radiating energy to distant planets where it draws seeds from the soil and puts warmth on skin. As humans, we desire to apply our force, our work, to the maximum effect possible. Our mission is what we want that force to accomplish. While the meaning of life might be complicated, your mission in life should not be complicated. What are you, in this lifetime, on this planet, in this body, here to do? What do you want more than anything else? My mission was to start a movement to help as many people as possible reach their potential. I didn't know what the brand looked like yet or how I was going to do it, but that didn't matter. What mattered was articulating and believing in the mission, finding that bright star in the vast darkness of the night sky, and then following it day in and day out. Once you have your mission, your next step is to sort out how your work can serve the mission. I'm a firm believer that there are two kinds of people in this world, those who need to find purpose and meaning in what they do for a living, and those who find purpose and meaning elsewhere and use work as a means to those ends. You can find yourself in either group by happenstance at any moment, which is why it's so important never to lose sight of your mission. If you need to have meaning in what you do, your profession should directly help your mission. If you want to save the oceans, become an oceanographer or marine biologist or a plastics chemist who changes the game. If your mission lies outside your work, you should look at your profession as the minimum effective way to gain the resources necessary to work toward your mission. Neither path is better or more valid than the other. I know numerous people from both sides who are equally happy or equally miserable, depending on whether they've found their mission and know which camp they're in. I'm fortunate that I've created a situation where I have purpose in what I do for a living. But that wasn't the case when my old employer came calling the second time. Except I had a plan. I just needed to buy enough time and gather enough resources to start on it. I didn't care if I was appreciated at my new old job. I didn't need a pat on the back. I just needed to do good work and get paid. In service of my mission, I was able to smile through the suck and learn from the dysfunctional management so I didn't make the same mistakes once I got my own thing off the ground. In short, I intentionally went into a toxic work environment day after day in order to emerge with the resources necessary to build my dream. The plan succeeded. Your mission is your purpose. Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, "The purpose of life is not to be happy. It is to be useful, to be honorable, to be compassionate, to have it make some difference that you have lived and lived well." Emerson is right, though I think the piece of that equation he failed to mention is that if you do all those things, be useful, honorable, compassionate, happiness tends to be the result. In his book Tribe, war reporter Sebastian Junger talks about how Londoners would reminisce about how they felt when the bombs were dropping. They had a purpose. They had a mission. Survive and win the war. This, then, is your job. To figure out your mission so you can own not just this day, but every day after it. Humans are happiest when they are working towards something, when they have a sense of purpose. Knowing your mission will help it turn your work from drudgery to a victory. Without a mission, it will take superhuman effort just to keep up the inspiration and motivation to make all the right choices necessary to own the day. So what do you want to do? What does your best self want more than anything else? Want so bad that your inability to stop thinking about it will make it impossible for anyone to stop you from achieving it. Think about it, because in a few chapters I'm going to ask you to write it down. Own your space. My office is a sanctuary. I have a Zen fountain. I have my favorite candle burning. I have a mini trampoline, a foot massager, a fridge full of endless kombucha, and a couple different places I can sit or stand. I'm fortunate to have my own office and that I can curate the space exactly how I want it. It is perfect. Not everyone is as lucky as I am. But owning your space is not just about the things in your office. It's also about how you engage with your space and how people interact with you while you're there. Any one of those three things can make a huge difference, positively or negatively, not just on your mission, but on your productivity and your overall happiness. So they should be given equal consideration as you rethink how you work. Can you smell what's cooking? Everything in the entire building may belong to the company that signs your checks, but ultimately you own your space. Sure, you may not be able to have a mini trampoline or a Zen fountain, but there is one thing you can do with any space, however large or small, and that is control the smell. Ooh, that smell. Let me smell that smell. What your workplace smells like makes a difference. If you ask employees at Onnit HQ, the scourge of the office is the microwave tilapia phenomenon. Putting two-day-old meal-prepped fish into the microwave offends every culinary sensibility a reasonable human should have, and it creates a stink bomb that lasts for hours and sticks to every conceivable surface like napalm. It's virtually inescapable, so when it happens, our usually zen and cheerful employees erupt into finger-pointing and complaints, myself occasionally leading the charge. The result is a cascading loss of effectiveness and overall happiness. Studies show that bad odor is not only distracting, but in some cases can elicit emotions like anger and disgust. Interestingly enough, if the smell of fish is the biggest disruptor of workplace productivity, research indicates that it is lemon, the same thing you use to disguise fishy taste, that might increase productivity the most. In Japan, according to the author of a book titled The Healthy Workplace, a large fragrance and flavor company investigated how smells affect the accuracy of typists. Their research found that 54% made fewer errors when they could smell lemon, 33% fewer with jasmine, and 20% fewer with lavender. Lemon, jasmine, lavender tea for the win. This is not news to anyone who has a little bit of experience smelling the roses, or all the other extracts from various plant roots, leaves, seeds, stems, and blossoms, otherwise known as essential oils. Essential oils have been used therapeutically for more than 6,000 years. What we now call aromatherapy has officially been around for a century. The exact mechanism of action is still a mystery to researchers, but what they do know is that certain oils, when inhaled or massaged into the skin, have been shown to reduce anxiety and stress, blood pressure, nausea, even depression. We've all had jobs that induce those symptoms, sometimes all at once, and it's a relief to know there is something natural out there that can help us combat them. You don't have to just use essential oils to get the desired effect, however. Depending on your situation, you could use a lemon-scented candle or an oil diffuser. You can rub lemongrass on your palms and smell, or simply put a fresh-cut lemon at your desk that you squeeze into your water. If you want to get fancy with the essential oils, try blending lemongrass and basil oil, or lemon and peppermint. Kick it up a notch, because the real power of smell and essential oils isn't in their acute ability to relieve negative sensations, it's in their ability to create positive ones. I call them trigger scents. And they work by reverse engineering the process by which, according to scientists at the University of Maryland Medical Center, the smell receptors in our noses communicate with parts of our brain that serve as storehouses for emotions and memories. Ever smell something that brings back a memory? Maybe it's a perfume or cologne that reminds you of your ex, Or maybe it's the smell of a food that brings back memories of a happy childhood. For a lot of us, Grandma's house had a certain smell that could trigger a nostalgic state of wistfulness. That is one of the powerful characteristics of scent, one you can use to your advantage at work by either piggybacking on positive memories you've already made or making new ones and deliberately associating a scent with them. For years, when I was meditating, I would burn North American white sage or the South American wood Palo Santo. After 10-plus years of steady meditation practice, smelling either of those scents, even just for a few seconds, will help put me into a meditative state. So when I know that I have a crazy week at the office ahead of me, filled with thousands of little decisions and dozens of fires to put out, I spark one of those scents, knowing that it will trigger the mindset I need for greater balance, contemplation, and contentment. You can do the same for all kinds of states. Suppose that every time you're going to try to enter flow state, you have a certain essential oil that you smell. After a while, your brain will link that flow state to the scent. Eventually, you will be able to use that scent in reverse, helping you to invoke that desired flow state, just like I use sage and Palo Santo to elicit a meditative state. How do you want to feel about your workspace? Do you want to imbue it with energy? Do you want it to be warm and cozy and safe? Experiment with the oils that make the most sense to you for your environmental goals at work and create a trigger scent. Have fun with it. Make it your own. And if you're one of those people whose spirit animal is a junkyard tomcat who doesn't want to be bothered, just keep a microwave at your desk and zap a tilapia fillet every hour or so. No one will bother you ever again. Punctuate your day with proper posture. One of my worst habits is poor posture. I'm a slumper, I'm a slouch, and I pay the price. My head pushes too far forward, putting strain on my neck and the supporting muscles. My traps are always too tight because my hands are elevated too high. My joints are less and less flexible the harder I work. If I'm writing, I can sit for upward of 12 hours a day. My spine ends up bent like a question mark when I should be sitting like an exclamation point. All of this is not good. Sitting for more than 3 hours a day can cut 2 years off your life expectancy, even if you exercise regularly. I'm way beyond 3 hours. So I work on it. I stand up more. I fix my posture. I know how important this is, so at my company we made Varidesk and all forms of ergonomic chairs, including stability balls, free upon request. I see more and more utilization every day, which is good for my employees as human beings and good for me as their boss. The Washington State Department of Labor and Industries reviewed 250 workplace ergonomics case studies, and they not only found regular increases in productivity where meaningful ergonomic intervention occurred, but also a dramatic reduction in strain-related injuries and absenteeism. It makes sense. For many people, work is already stressful enough. Who wants to spend 8 hours in what amounts to a stress position? If you work at a company, send them this research and see if they will get you what you are looking for. If you own the company, what you invest in your employees will always yield a great return. So take a good hard look at your ergonomic options. In the meantime, take matters into your own hands today and start straightening out that question mark of a body into an exclamation point of pride. Sitting, standing, and movement. The key to good ergonomics is to vary your position regularly from sitting to standing, and to move your body in between to make sure that your muscles don't cramp or tighten. When you are sitting, even if you like to slouch, spend some time with classic good posture. Engage your core to straighten your back. Rotate your pelvis forward, like you were trying to move your taint to the front of your seat, and push your chin back to straighten your neck. This may be uncomfortable at first, so treat it like resistance training. Do a little bit every day until it becomes easier and easier. If you have the flexibility, bring your feet up to a squat in the chair or cross your legs, eventually advancing from Indian style to what the yogis call full lotus, where the outsides of your ankles rest on the inside of your opposing thigh. A Bosu ball, if you have one at your disposal, forces much of this better posture by virtue of its shape and elasticity. You have to sit up straight with your small balance muscles engaged, or the ball will roll out from under you. Try slouching into it while you work, and it will only be a matter of seconds before you land flat on your back. This is advanced ergonomics, though, so it's best to work up to that. When standing, once again, rotate your pelvis forward, pull the chin back, and ideally take off your shoes and spread your toes so all those little piggies make contact with the ground. A lot of foot problems come from shoes forcing your feet far narrower than we were biomechanically engineered. And once foot problems settle in, they start to travel up the posterior chain as you try to compensate for the discomfort. Pro tip, better shoes and toe spreaders. There's nothing dorkier than wearing your five-finger Vibram shoes to the office or out to dinner. I love my Vibrams. Each toe can move independently, my foot can spread out, and I get to build strength from the ground up. I work out in them 90% of the time and feel like Arnold training barefoot at Muscle Beach. But I still can't bring myself to wear them outside the gym where I spend the other 15 of my waking hours. So the answer is to purchase some wide toe box shoes. Companies like Altra and Kuru have sprung up who make some great training, casual, and running shoes with a wide toe box so you can move your feet a little bit more like nature intended. To help correct years of unintentional foot binding, you can also check out toe spreaders like those made by Yoga Toes or Correct Toes. They feel a bit like getting braces on your toes, but after a while, you'll start to reap the benefits. Movement, usually in the form of some light, resisted stretching, is something you should do both seated and standing. When you get up from your desk, do a few squats, some light spinal twists, or some calf raises. Open up your rib cage with one of those big, good morning world type yawn stretches. In yoga, this looks like the first part of the sun salutation. While you're seated, there are a number of movements you can do. Chin retractions. The goal of the chin push is to push your chin down and back, elongating the neck and setting a better alignment for your head on your shoulders. Do 3 sets of 10 reps. Holding a duration of 2 seconds each time. Draw the shoulders down. Holding your chin in the position you just patterned, reaching your hands toward the floor, draw your shoulders down to your sides, stretching and lengthening the traps, which are one of the main places many of us hold our stress, especially if we are holding our hands too high when we type. The shoulders tense up and then they get tight, which leads to tightness in the neck and the traps, and eventually headaches. Gently push your ear down toward your shoulder, increasing the stretch on the opposite trap. Hold for 10 seconds at a time. Do 10 sets for a total of 100 seconds. People are strange when you are stranger. We are each part of an energetic bioorganism in both our home and work environments. We may have our own bedrooms or our own office, but we do not exist in isolation. We are social creatures and emotional beings who are incredibly adept at detecting others' emotions. If you are having a bad day, if you are stressed, if you are elated, people will pick up on what you are going through. The recent discovery of mirror neurons in the brain, which reflect the emotional state of the person with whom we are interacting at any given moment, has uncovered how this process works neurochemically. It's basically a hardwired version of empathy. Any of us who have been around someone who is frantic can recognize this phenomenon in action. If we're not careful, that chaos rubs off on us. Same goes for when someone angrily honks their car horn at us, and it makes us angry as well. I remember I shared my office for a few months with a coworker. He was prone to bouts of stress and anxiety, and I would hear him letting out deep sighs. This was good for him, but it was bad for me. Every time I heard him purge the energy, it would make me aware of his emotional state, and before I knew it, I was mirroring his emotional energy with my own behavior. Initially, it was really frustrating because it felt like the emotional version of a sick person coming into the office and coughing on everything. he was sighing his negative energy all over my desk. Eventually, we chatted about what I call energetic hygiene and determined that the best thing for him to do was head outside and blow off a little steam on his own when he needed to, then re-enter the office. In reality, I'd already determined for myself the actual best thing, and that was for him to get the hell out and give me my office back. But I didn't propose that right away, because just as important as being cautious about our energetic hygiene is being a good teammate. There is no I in team, but there is a me. We talk a lot about teamwork in our society. Teamwork makes the dream work. But we don't talk nearly enough about how to be a good teammate, or how to judge whether you are working well with your team, or how to know who is actually on your team. Even if you work on your own, at some point or another, you are going to be interacting with someone who supports what you do. If it's not a coworker, maybe it's your spouse, or even your dog. If you don't walk your dog, then he's going to shit in your house, and so you traded a nice sunny walk in support of your teammate for angrily cleaning up the pile of shit he made, left to his own devices. It's the same when we don't communicate with people at work and support them in the ways that are most useful to them as opposed to most obvious or convenient to us. I learned that lesson the first time I was invited back to the UFC locker room before a fight to hang with a fighter we were working with. I thought we needed to keep things intense. It seemed obvious to me. What I didn't appreciate was that the fight was already intense enough, and getting intense is easy for a fighter. Staying loose enough to have snap in your punches and keep your adrenaline from dumping too early, that is the challenge. So the best thing the people in a fighter's corner can do, leading up to the walkout where shit gets real, is crack jokes. Laughter is the diffuser of intensity. One of the greatest Buddhist teachers of our time is the Jamaican-born Muji, the Laughing Buddha. He got his name because people will travel from all over the world to see him with their problems. And by the time they are ready to tell him what's wrong, they start laughing. He has an incredible gift of pointing out the silliness and futility of many of our emotional challenges, which diffuses them immediately. In fact, evolutionary biologists credit laughter with exactly that purpose, diffusing what would ordinarily be tense situations. The moment you can laugh about something, the threat is over. If anyone is in an energetically challenging place, instead of indulging it or telling them to fix it, be a good teammate and shoot for laughter. Farts count, but only if they are loud. A good teammate announces his farts proudly. Work effectively. I know that I am a streak worker. I can accomplish a normal week of work in a day, but I can only do one of those days twice a week. My goal is to learn to operate at that high capacity without the burnout that forces me to need so many recovery days. I want to be able to turn on that skill at will, rather than waiting around for inspiration like I'm holding a bingo card, hoping the letters F-L-O-W line up. The best way for me to make that happen is to get into a rhythm with some easy housekeeping tasks, then go in on the most important thing on my to-do list, by saying no to the things of lesser priority and blocking out distractions that could get in the way. About those emails. The first thing I do when I start the workday is check my texts and my emails. While it is true that email has been shown to be a hindrance to workplace production, 70% of people react to new emails within 6 seconds of notification. And it takes about 64 seconds to return to the original task after every email. Any book that tells you to do something else besides look at your emails when you get to work is bullshit, because you won't actually follow it. In your email, you might discover something that you need to devote all your time to that day. I've had that scenario develop a dozen times. A website outage, a supply problem, a human resources situation. Something that if I don't give it immediate attention, will do exponential damage. I have to check my emails or I am going to be stressed about it. For the most part, it's annoying housekeeping work, but it's also a chance for some easy productivity wins that help reduce some of the noise that so often drowns out the all-important signal. This doesn't mean that I answer any of my emails, however. This is one case where technology is really helpful. In Gmail, which is industry standard if you want anyone to take you seriously, there is a star system. They have yellow stars, blue stars, and a whole progression of simple, clickable icons by which you can sort your emails. I use three of them. Blue star.